I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. When Jesse Green, now chief theater critic for the New York Times, showed composer and writer Mary Rodgers the first 10 pages of her memoir that they were working on together, she told him, make it funnier, make it meaner. She died in 2014 before the book was completed, and I don't know if it's as funny and mean as she hoped it would be. Shy, the alarmingly outspoken memoirs of Mary Rodgers, is a revealing, entertaining, dishy, and disarmingly honest account of growing up the daughter of Broadway royalty, famed composer Richard Rodgers and his wife, Dorothy. In Mary's telling, they are were terrible parents, critical and self-centered. She was a rebellious child and adult, determined to live her life on her own terms. As a young woman, she kept falling in love with the wrong men, including Stephen Sondheim, with whom she had a short-term pretend marriage. They remained lifelong friends. Mary Rodgers did have a rich and creative life, the composer of Once Upon a Mattress and author of Freaky Friday. Jesse Green joins us on Radio Times to tell us about the life and times of Mary Rodgers, how they collaborated on this book. And Jesse Green, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us, and I really enjoyed this book. There is so much to talk about, but let me begin with the title, and it does feel as if the title of your book is at war with the subtitle of your book, Shy, the Alarmingly Outspoken Memoirs of Mary Rodgers. Tell us how you came up with the title.
Well, it's certainly an ironic title, but it has several purposes. One is one of the most famous songs she wrote in Once Upon a Mattress, was called Shy, and although it was a fictional work, of course, and the plot was determined by others, it wound up having a lot to do with her. It's the story of a princess who is trying to find love and life on her own terms and is blocked by expectations of what a woman should be in the kingdom she finds herself in. So she sings this song, Shy, which is completely false. She's bellowing it to the rafters. It's a very funny song, and Mary was just the same way, the least shy person you could ever encounter in many ways at a party or, over dinner. But on the other hand, someone who had a lot of internal conflict to work out and protect, a lot of it based on, as you say, the childhood she had, or she would say she endured, like a prisoner under her parents' thumbs.
And I do want to talk about all of that, and I'll just tell our listeners we're going to end the show with the song Shy, just to kind of put some bookends around our conversation. As I mentioned, she died in 2014, having told you, make it meaner, make it funnier. What was she looking for in the telling of her story?
Well, when we had started talking about the book, she had a rather long list of things she did not want it to be. She didn't want it to be and then I wrote kind of memoir. Right. She didn't want it to be self-serving. She didn't want it to be especially like the books her parents had written about their lives, which she considered to be basically fantasias on a false idea of who they actually were. So she was very invested in it telling as much of the truth as she could safely put out there, and I would say she's up to the high 90s as far as that goes.
Yeah.
But also she was very concerned with the idea that she, as a young woman of her era, had no benefit of the stories and histories and learning of women of the previous generation, certainly not from her mother, who would never tell her anything true about sex, for instance, and who raised her to be a prude, which she definitively was not in the end. So she wanted a book that would actually go, if anything, would err on the side of oversharing so that she wouldn't be making the same mistake that she felt she had suffered from in not gaining the benefit of the wisdom and the life experience of other women. So I think when she said, make it funnier, make it meaner, she really was saying, make it count, make people feel it, not just sound like, ordinary and then I did kind of things. And I was, frankly, I was a little shocked because the pages I had handed her were well, really, really mean.
It's apparently not mean enough.
I thought I went as far as I could go.
But she wanted more. But that tells us a lot about her, obviously.
Yeah, and it wasn't that she was a mean person.
It's
that she experienced a lot of bad behavior in her life and, as she freely admits, engaged in a fair amount of bad behavior, which she, unlike in many cases, she absorbed the criticism for, rethought, and changed herself. And one of the messages in the book, I think, or one of the stories she wanted to tell and I wanted to tell, was how a woman of, you know, can change, how a woman can look to the many different things she might be able to do and have the bravery to move on when something doesn't work. She feels that that's a womanly quality that most of the men she knew, certainly in that era, did not have and suffered for.
Well, Jesse, I'd love to have you read just a paragraph from the book. It starts the chapter, Love Me Tonight, and it's about her father, Richard Rogers.
Yes, just so you know, Love Me Tonight is the name of an early Rogers and Hart song. Glad to. Now, understand I'm reading in Mary's voice.
Yes.
So I can't put on the actual sound,
no.
But I'm going to try to say it the way she would have said it. Somewhere, there's a wonderful home movie of Daddy playing with me on a lawn. He looks happy, as adorable as anybody would be with a chubby new baby. I couldn't have been a year old. The first time I saw it, I almost burst into tears, though I rarely cry. I taught myself not to because I never wanted to give my mother, who cried constantly, the satisfaction. When I was punished or humiliated for doing something wrong, and I was always doing something wrong, I used to look up at the sky and think, don't cry, don't cry, don't let her know she got to you. To this day, I let myself cry only at lovely things, like when someone unexpectedly apologizes to someone else, or at acts of selfless kindness. But watching Daddy in a pair of swimming trunks on the grass, beaming at me with good-natured, silly joy, I thought, where did that nice man go?
Hmm. It's a heartbreaking paragraph, and she says obviously so much there about herself and about her parents. She goes on to describing her father, quote, hated having his time wasted with intangible things like emotions, found excess of any sort distasteful. He thought her laugh was too loud, that she was too fat. I mean, talk about critical. How did she deal with that level of criticism, frankly?
Well, not very well at first. As a child, she reacted to it by being what she called rotten. She was constantly misbehaving in kind of egregious ways, which her parents couldn't see for what it was. They could only see it as further evidence of her not, you know, there being something wrong with her or being too much. He also said, and this is just a terrible thing, that her laugh was too loud and her smile was too big. I think you mentioned that one. And I just, like, what kind of thing is that to say to a child? But the thing is, there's a way in which selfish parenting obviously can be a disaster, but it can also in certain ways be a gift. Because for Mary, it was the beginning of rebellion, which was not against nothing. Her parents were fairly accurate representations of a kind of repressive state of the time. Remember, she's growing up in the 30s and 40s. And in rebelling against them, she discovered ways of rebelling against the expectations for a young woman of that time, particularly a privileged woman on the one hand, but also being Jewish, someone who was tremendously limited in certain kinds of opportunities by quotas. There was a quota at her school for Jews, and there were no blacks at all. Quotas in terms of who could join a board for board membership, and other kinds of exclusions that she at first was disappointed by and then learned to crash through. So her way of dealing with all that, and it's not just her father. I mean, in a way, her father was the milder figure of the two between her father and mother. But her way of dealing with that was simply to hold it in until she had the least little corner of freedom, and then to yank on that freedom for all she was worth and get out.
and get out, which she does. And describing her mother, she said that she wouldn't get down on her knees to play with us because then she'd have to send her pants to be pressed. Now, on the one hand, that's very funny. But on the other hand, the thought of a parent sort of unwilling to get on the floor to play with a child, again, is borderline shocking, at least to me.
Yeah, I found it shocking. There was a lot that happened in our conversations where I just had to stop, you know, and put down the very lovely teacup that she had provided and just say, what is that? That really happened? And, you know, I did a lot of checking and it all really happened. But, her mother was a very clever woman. She gives her mother a great deal of credit for dealing with the problems of her own time, which... you might say even more repressive than Mary's time. She was an inventor who has several patents. She ran a clever company. She was a philanthropist. She did a lot of good in her life, but she was kind of universally acknowledged as an ice princess and, made her life's business to control her children. And of course, you know, Mary, as she said, was bloody-minded and was going to do whatever she could to get away from that. And one of the first things she did was fall in love with the theater, and through the theater, fall in love with people whom her parents would have found and did find extremely inappropriate.
There's a wonderful description where she describes, she's actually a child, I think it's her 3-year-old birthday. She says, let's face it, most of childhood is the most boring prison sentence in the world, and you can't get paroled. It's a surprise that I became, as the nursery rhyme says of me, quite contrary. And then she goes on to describe that everyone's singing Mary Had a Little Lamb at her birthday party, where she is mouthing the words to the farmer in the dell. I love that.
Yes. I also love that scene because all the other kids, this is when her family was living in California, and several of the other kids were the children of famous parents who had bodyguards around because this was not long after the Lindbergh baby was kidnapped. And she was just mad as hell that her parents wouldn't get her a bodyguard. But she later realized that maybe her parents didn't think it would be such a bad idea if she were kidnapped.
Well, and there she is, you know, mouthing the words to a different nursery rhyme, yeah. Which I think tells us a lot about Mary Rogers. Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking with Jesse Green. He's the chief theater critic for the New York Times, and about 10 years ago, he and Mary Rogers began to work on her memoir. She died in 2014. He continued to refine the work and edit it and do interviews for it, and it has now been published, and it's titled Shy, The Alarmingly Outspoken Memoirs of Mary Rogers. And we're going to play some clips, some interviews after this short break. You can always join our conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking with Jesse Green about his memoir that he co-authored with Mary Rogers. It's titled Shy, The Alarmingly Outspoken Memoirs of Mary Rogers. And we've been talking a lot about her parents, her famous father, Richard Rogers, and his wife, Dorothy. Let me play a clip, and this is Mary Rogers. It's 1996. It's on a weekly interview series called Theater Talk, and that focuses on the world of stage. And here she is, Mary Rogers, talking about her father, Richard Rogers.
With a lot of people who are, you know, who suffer from dysthymia, which is a mild form of depression, or a more severe form, so much energy goes into pretending that that's not a problem, that it was hard to detect. I just knew that he often seemed unhappy, and as he got older, he was definitely unhappy.
And Jesse, so much of this book is, and I think for adult parents, part of life is trying to figure out one's own parents and whether to forgive them or not, or love them or not, or understand them or not. And it seemed like she had spent certainly a lot of her adult life trying to put her parents into some kind of a context.
Yes, and it was made particularly difficult by the fact that she elected to enter a field in which her father was the giant.
That's right.
So she wasn't exactly, excusing herself into another room, although, you know, she didn't mean ever to compete with him, knowing what the result of that would be. Yet, in the end, they wound up both nominated for Tony Award in the same year, for South Pacific on Richard Rodgers' part, and for Once Upon a Mattress on Mary's part. Mary did not win.
Right.
But the interesting thing is that she was, in the long run, able to forgive her father. She began to understand his depression, also his alcoholism, when maids who worked for the family discovered that he was hiding bottles of liquor in the toilet tank. It was a very clever way of hiding the huge amount of drinking he did, which, of course, affected the depression. But whereas her mother was just controlling and didn't seem to offer very much else in return, her father offered music. And music, whether she was writing music or just enjoying it, was the key for her. And in the end, she felt that he did love her, and the way he loved her was through the music.
In fact, she says, Oh, I'm sorry. No, she says everything loving came out in his music, and then she goes on to say it was enough.
It was enough. And actually, in the end, he came to respect her musicality as well. During the early years of her career, she had some trouble where, first of all, people did not believe that a young woman could be a composer. There had been virtually no women composers on Broadway, certainly not of a big musical like Once Upon a Mattress. And people, you know, spread the rumor that he had written these songs, to which she's, you know, she was both flattered by that and appalled by that, and would say, you know, why would he write my songs? He doesn't even like my songs. She would show them, she would play them to him occasionally, and he would comment on them in a very brusque way, and until she finally decided she would never play them for him again. And yet, later on in his old age, when he, you know, was beginning to greatly fear the loss of his own talent and doubt his abilities, it was Mary he called on to come help. And he, in fact, at one point asked if she would be willing to write the lyrics for The Sound of Music, of all things, because Oscar Hammerstein had recently been diagnosed with what would turn out to be his fatal disease.
Wow. She says about her parents, straight through my life, everywhere you look, they were horrible, especially my mother, about little things, but important things they were wonderful about. And then she goes on to say, the trouble is, and this is the key, it doesn't even out. Even in my admittedly rather eventful life, there weren't as many big things as little. And I thought that was profound and moving and something that I think that all parents should think about.
Yes, you really need to be good on the small things and not just the big things. It's kind of easy to come in as the savior, isn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, okay, here's the money you need to get out of this hole, or here we'll bring you back home from this situation that didn't work out. But on a daily basis, to support your child as they struggle to find a place for themselves in the world is much more difficult. They were amazing in certain ways. Of course, they were very rich, so they could be amazing when she and her husband got into, her second husband, got into a ridiculous and terrible debt for reasons that are too long to go into here, but you can read in the book. And they just listened to the story. It's kind of a painful situation, actually. They, Dorothy and Richard and the lawyer and Mary, are sitting in the living room of the Rogers' home discussing it, while her husband Hank, who was the cause of the problem, was asked to sit on a bench in Central Park and await the decision. So it was lordly even at that, but they did, you know, they simply wrote a check and covered the entire debt, which was the equivalent of perhaps $1 million.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, and that is a big thing. Let me play another clip. This is Mary Rogers talking with playwright and screenwriter Marsha Norman. This is back in 2012, again about her parents, and this is part of the Dramatists Guild Foundation's Legacy Project.
All I wanted was to get out of the house, which is why the lack of freedom drove me crazy. I was a very rebellious kid, and I would lie. I thought my parents didn't know what they were doing when I was about 5 years old. I remember thinking, these guys don't know how to do this. When I get grown up, I'm going to have children, and I'm not going to do it that way.
Did she do it her way with her children?
Oh, she definitely did it her way. I mean, throughout the book, she gives occasional parenting tips that are kind of shocking. But she essentially, and this isn't always a good idea. I think she came to understand that making decisions like that reactively can cause you to go too far in the other direction. But she certainly erred on the side of giving her children a great deal of freedom and opportunity. As a minor example, she wanted them to understand how to use curse words correctly, which means it was fine to say these whatever word you wanted, and she taught them the words at home with each other, maybe with your friends, but you would not do it, for instance, in a church or in a synagogue. And she felt that if you didn't allow them to understand that things had contexts in which they were correct or incorrect, they could never develop a moral consciousness. And she did have 6 children, 5 of whom survived into adulthood, so she had a lot of practice with these parenting techniques. And all I can say is the kids are fabulous, so I guess they worked.
And not too potty-mouthed, I guess, in public.
Well, they're fairly potty.
aren't we all these days? Let me just quickly reintroduce our guest. Jesse Green is the chief theater critic for the New York Times, and he collaborated with Mary Rogers on her memoir. It's titled Shy, the alarmingly outspoken memoirs of Mary Rogers. She is the composer of Once Upon a Mattress. She wrote a book called Freaky Friday that was made into a movie. She was, head of the board at Juilliard? Do I have that right?
She was chairman, yeah.
Chairman of the board. And worked with Leonard Bernstein on the Young People's Concerts that I remember as a kid.
Basically, she was everywhere in the culture for 50 years. She wasn't necessarily known, certainly not at the level of many of the people she worked with, her father, Leonard Bernstein, Stephen Sondheim, people like that, but was right in the middle of it. And that's part of what fascinated me about her originally. Just the people she knew, the people whose pictures were in the silver frames on the piano in her living room, and the piano was Richard Rodgers' Steinway. Mm. You know, all of that, you know, made her a figure of fascination and also of some curiosity. Why had a woman with obvious talent as a composer and in many other areas, and a woman who was so central in that world, why had her career gone the way it did, where she had to decide at certain points, I'm going to put that arrow away and try another one, and have success in each one she tried.
And there are a lot of famous names in this book. She has some very pointed things to say about them, about Hal Prince. She said, Hal was born clasping a lisp of people he wanted to meet. He described 21-year-old Barbara Streisand, who she met, I think, at a cabaret, this gawky woman gobbling a peach, her hair still braided up like a challah. Talking about Woody Allen practicing sex, possibly from a manual. He was doing better, it seemed, with the clarinet. And then about Arthur Laurent, she says, talent excuses almost anything but Arthur Lorentz. What was the problem she had with him?
Well, there are a lot of problems she had with him, and one of the biggest ones, and the one I feel is most important to learn from myself at any rate, she stood by for many years as his friend, very good friend, and watched as he would just destroy other people, destroy them, with nasty commentary in public, or spreading rumors about them that hurt them personally or hurt them in their careers, stealing stories from people's lives to put in his work, all kinds of really obnoxious behavior, which she was too afraid to criticize him for fear that he would turn on her. Mm-hmm. She describes herself as very likely being that she very likely would have made a very good collaborator in Vichy France. And she didn't mean the kind who wrote musicals together.
Yeah.
She it finally got to the point, and this was one of the places where she drew the line about what she would talk about. She discussed, you know, some of his general bad behavior. There was personal bad behavior with her family, and then she drew the line after that and did not want to publish, you know, exactly what it was that happened between them. But she finally saw what she had done by supporting him, or at least standing by silently all those years, and she finally cut it off with him, as did Sondheim eventually, around the same time.
Well, and she and Sondheim, they met when they were teenagers, remained lifelong friends, and she says about him, "I was dazzled by Steve, completely stunned. I knew right away he was brilliant. He just reeked of talent, which not illogically was always the biggest turn-on for me. I married two tall, blue-eyed men, but the ones I had the most fun with were dark, and boy, Steve was dark." Tell us about their relationship.
Well, as you say, they met when she was 13 and he was 14. And again, you know, everything in her life has to be just that much more special and unusual. Where did they meet? They met at Oscar Hammerstein's house in Bucks County. Hammerstein had a way of sort of collecting strays, particularly young people who had inadequate parenting, which is a good description of Sondheim at the time. And he would hang around there, and eventually Hammerstein became his mentor. But and Mary showed up there one day, one weekend, probably when her father and Oscar Hammerstein were working on Carousel, possibly, and met this guy who, you know, said, "Let's play chess." And they played three games of chess, at which he, you know, creamed her instantaneously, and then went to the piano and played her some Gershwin. And that was it for her for the rest of her life. He was, in many ways, the love of her life, if we describe love broadly. I mean, right. She had very powerful romantic relationships and marital relationships, but this was the through line, and it was I kind of chose to make it the through line of the book as well. He was the only person who not only equaled her father, she felt, but was superior to him in talent, and that's what she means by naturally, you know, his musical abilities were a turn-on for her. She, in a way, he was a representation of the taste and the genius that she had been raised to appreciate, and yet also a breaking through the barrier of the era in which her father's expression of that taste had been dominant. Because, of course, as we all know, Sondheim changed the musical theater forever, in part by undoing the Rodgers and Hammerstein revolution.
Yeah, fascinating. I mean, they had this, I don't even know what to call it exactly, this trial marriage. I mean, they didn't get married, but it sounds like his psychiatrist felt it was a good idea for them to, I guess, what, live together, sleep in the same bed together. A very odd arrangement, it seems.
It is one of the most awkward scenes I've ever put together. I mean, when I say I put together, I was putting it together from her stories and her words, but as I tried to figure out how to present it so that it wouldn't be just unbearable in its awkwardness, mm-hmm. I had a lot of trouble because, you know, on the one hand, she's been in love with him all her life. She's gotten through one bad marriage, has three kids, she's single, she's trying to find someone to marry because she, you know, doesn't feel like she understands how she could possibly live with three children unless she were married. She has been dating kind of widely during this period, and she finally realizes, you know, this is the man I've always loved. And it's not the most erotic relationship ever, but there's other ways you can, as she says, there's other ways you can skin that cat. And she was receptive when he made the suggestion, not perhaps at first understanding that it was a kind of psychiatric experiment.
Yeah.
And boy, was it awkward. But the happy news is that when they both understood that it was not to be, they remained friends, very, very good friends, with a few eruptions here or there, but till the end of her life. And at her memorial, he played a beautiful song he had written based on a song they had worked on when they were kids together.
Well, let me just quote her. She says, "So we would get into the same bed side by side, frozen with fear. We just lay there. We didn't discuss anything. We didn't do anything. If we touched, it was en passant." Again, the kind of, you know, intimate awkwardness.
Yes, well, that was her métier, intimate awkwardness. I think you've said it very well. And I've only just now realized that she used a chess term to describe it, en passant, being
something to do with
a pawn in playing chess. And I didn't realize it at the time. Mary was extremely clever with words, as you must know by reading the book. Her family played lots of word games as well as math games, which she hated. She was a pretty excellent Scrabble player, as I had reason to discover later in life. And basically enjoyed wordplay of all kinds. It wasn't always immediately evident to me when she was, you know, using the wordplay. I would discover it later as I was working on the material, or in this case, just now.
Yeah, well, interesting. And she says, "I was a bit of a pawn in their psychiatric gamesmanship." Talking just to...
there you are.
Yeah, and this is her, and this is Stephen Sondheim and his psychiatrist thinking perhaps this is a good idea. And of course, this is when everyone was, or most everyone was in the closet.
Yes, well, she had a lot of sympathy for gay men. Her first husband, as it turned out, was gay. And it was a very difficult marriage, although it produced three pretty great kids. And she did learn to become close with him again after their contentious divorce. She understood what it meant to be a gay man at that time. And she says at one point, everybody should marry a gay man at least once. and he wasn't, as the Sondheim story indicates, he wasn't the last gay man. She took an interest in that way. Her longtime collaborator in musical theater, Marshall Bearer, who was not only very gay and had a male lover, but was crazy, was very interested in marrying her. It was a thing a gay man could do to get some legitimacy in that time.
Yeah.
And when her father found out about this idea, he called her into his office and said, "You know, Mary, those marriages never work, but... you know, so why don't you just go all the way and marry Truman Capote?"
Oh, my goodness. Well, let's take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation with Jesse Green. The book is Shy, the Alarmingly Outspoken Memoirs of Mary Rodgers.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Mary Rodgers was the daughter of Broadway royalty fame composer Richard Rodgers. And on today's Radio Times, I'm talking with New York Times chief theater critic Jesse Green about Mary Rodgers' frank and funny memoir that they worked on together. It's ironically titled Shy, the Alarmingly Outspoken Memoirs of Mary Rodgers. And we were just talking about Stephen Sondheim. Let me play just a very short clip from a piece of music that Sondheim and Mary Rodgers worked on together. It's titled The Boy From. Let's give it a quick listen.
Why, when I speak, does he vanish? Oh, why is he acting so clannish? Oh, I wish I understood Spanish.
And that's from The Mad Show. I mean, that, obviously the Girlfriend Ben Nima type music, but that's a lot of fun, Jesse.
Well, The Mad Show, as you can imagine, based on the magazine, was a kind of thumb-your-nose review at everything that musical theater and that society had been. And so it included a lot of wonderful sketches, and Mary wrote the music for that takeoff, as you say, on The Girl from Ipanema. And she and Steve Sondheim wrote the lyrics for it, which, you know, again, in retrospect, she realizes it's a song about a woman in love with a gay man.
Yeah.
this boy from this unpronounceable long title. And it's become a cabaret staple ever since. I'm fascinated by the idea of these two close friends for life who also worked together and learned from each other and struggled together in their early years, much in the way that many of us do with our friends in whatever fields we go into. There's some ways in which the story is just so relatable and touching about, you know, young love disappointed and looking for the right person, even though the details of it are so extremely sort of outrageously central to the culture of that time. So that there's a very touching moment in the story when Sondheim, in essence, comes out to her, takes place as they're sitting on the floor in her parents' house underneath that piano again, Richard Rodgers' piano. I loved hearing stories like that from her, and of course wanted to highlight them as I wrote the book.
So why did he say when told, or I guess approached the idea that Mary was going to write a memoir, why did he say, what's so interesting about Mary? Because she's fascinating, and he would have known that, wouldn't he?
He didn't think there was anything interesting about himself. So we have to start with that premise.
Okay.
He thought that people in the arts should only be known or were best known through their work. And in everything he wrote about his work, he never really talked about his personal life except as a sidelight. It's, of course, come up in biographies. But basically, he was just wrong. And I did convince him of that eventually when I talked him through why Mary's life was so fascinating. And the thing that he really glommed onto was realizing that the story, you know, that her story as a young woman trying to do these things was unique, particularly given who her parents are, and also, as it wound up, one of her children, who is also a Broadway composer, Adam Gettle.
Well, let's talk about Once Upon a Mattress, and she wrote the music for this. And it's the Princess and the Pea story, but where did this idea come from?
Well, this guy, Marshall Bearer, I mentioned earlier, who was a friend and a collaborator of hers, had long had this idea of doing a kind of Borscht Belt retelling of The Princess and the Pea. For Nancy Walker was his idea, and he encouraged Mary to join him one summer at a place called Tamament up in the Poconos, which was kind of a summer camp for would-be musical theater people or people, you know, training to become composers and lyricists and book writers and performers. And a lot of the summer was spent writing reviews and then trying to write longer shows if possible. So that's one of the things they worked on that summer. In fact, they wrote the first version of the show there in 3 weeks. And when they came to New York with it, George Abbott signed on, the great mid-century director of musical theater, and he didn't want to use Nancy Walker, who was an established star, but he wanted to create his own star. And they did a long search, and they found this young girl living in Brooklyn named Carol Burnett.
Wow.
And as Mary always said, she barely had to come into the city to audition. You could hear her from Brooklyn.
And we will play a bit of Carol Burnett at the very end of the show. It's played a lot these days. You performed in Once Upon a Mattress, didn't you, Jesse? I think I read that at the end of the book.
Yes, like almost everyone.
Yeah, exactly.
I performed in it twice. I was once the prince himself.
Oh, wow.
And I was once, ironically, Sir Studley. So I knew the show inside out well before I met Mary. The songs are really incredible, and it's a terrible loss, in my opinion, that although she had some shows produced after Once Upon a Mattress, including The Mad Show that we've discussed, and including an enormous vehicle for Judy Holliday called Hotspot, she didn't have much success with those shows after Once Upon a Mattress and The Mad Show. And she kept writing, but she moved on to other things. I've heard a lot of the later music, and it's really good.
Oh, wow.
And it shows her moving forward past the kind of thumb-your-nose fun, in the Rodgers and Hart, Rodgers and Hammerstein mode, and into something that prefigures, in a way, the work of her son, Adam Gettle. But she, you know, she had other things she wanted to try, and they turned out to be successful as well.
Did she see some of the parallels between her life or her relationship with her mother and this story, the princess who, you know, tries to outwit the icy vein queen?
Only in retrospect, she
really?
Said. To me, it was pretty evident, but she says that, you know, that's not the way things happened for her. She didn't set out thinking, here are my themes, here are the things that interest me and that bother me, and I'm going to find ways to write about them. What happens is somebody calls and says, oh, I want to do this. Are you interested? And you say yes. And she said yes to everything. Who knows which of them would have hit? It seemed kind of unlikely that this would be the one, but, you know, it didn't matter. She wrote for the Prince Spaghetti Day commercials, and she wrote for Rin Tin Tin, and she wrote for Captain Kangaroo, and, you know, whatever came up, she would sit down and write for it, which was not the easiest thing in the world to do when you had three kids under the age of seven, you know, biting at your feet. It's amazing that she was able to do it at all, and kind of admirable. But she, you know, when I would talk to her about, don't you see how this is your life, she would admit that it does seem that way in retrospect, but that it must have been an unconscious attraction at the time.
Well, she wrote, it's a young adult book called A Freaky Friday. It was made into a movie. I believe she did the screenplay for that. And again, this is about a mother and daughter who sort of switch bodies. And,
yes.
You know, based on what you said about her relationship with her mother and the kind of person that her mother was, I mean, how Freudian do you want to get?
Well, in that case, it was less unconscious. She was really after a point in those books that was Freaky Friday, followed by several others, enormously successful and influential and still read by millions today.
Yeah.
In Freaky Friday, in particular, by having the mother and daughter switch, it wasn't just a comic premise. It was also the idea that the girl, the daughter, should learn what responsibilities control a parent and force them to act in ways that the child may not understand at first, and vice versa. So in a way, you could say she was trying to repair the mother-daughter relationship that had not worked out well in her own life, and also to forgive. I don't know that she ever fully forgave her mother, but in the book, she does forgive the mother, and that was going to have to suffice.
Well, and that's what fiction is for, right?
Exactly.
She says about her mother, she didn't love me, but she liked me. And, I mean, do you think that was enough for Mary Rogers?
No, it was the other way around. She said, we love you, but we don't like you.
Oh, interesting. Well, that's Freudian for me to reverse that, so, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's, you know, I have to say, as a parent myself, there are times when you feel that way. But what you mean is that your behavior is bothering me right now, but I still love you. But coming from her mother, along with, you know, years and years of controlling and criticizing, it seemed more like if I didn't have to, I wouldn't have you in the house. And Mary often felt that she wasn't really happy to have been a mother, partly because it did not resolve the issues she had with her husband in a way Dorothy perhaps hoped that it would. Her husband, you know, continued to be a massive philanderer, as we hear about in some detail in the book.
Yeah. She says about her own children, why they love me, I'll never know.
Well, I know.
Well, tell us.
Whatever she may have lacked in terms of being there all the time, because she was, after all, you know, all running all around, doing shows, taking time away from the family to write, taking time away from the family to, you know, run institutions and things like that. She was the most fun woman I've ever met. Whether it was in going and doing something, going to a concert, the way she listened to music, the way she talked about it, or just sitting around and talking, you just left from any, you know, any conversation with her kind of hurting from laughing. And none of it was silly either. It was really about true things. And I maybe it's me, but I was just very primed at that time in my life when I met her, to hear, to have that kind of experience. And also to have a model of finding your own life that is not the one that your parents envisioned for you. I certainly lived that myself, and as a parent, I've had to, you know, learn that lesson over and over again, that whatever it is you think your parent, your kid should be, that is not yours to say, and you have to let them find their own way, which is something she certainly did. And I, you know, I think they all recognize that. They, you know, maybe they have some criticisms, you know, based on ordinary day-to-day life, but you know, I think they were all thrilled to have her as a mother.
Do you miss her? She died in 2014, and you spent a lot of time with her, essentially typing her memoirs.
Well, I was typing what she said and also what I said. I wouldn't describe it as typing her memoirs because, you know, that was just a transcript,
yes,
and then
no,
I had to write a whole book.
Right.
But and I had been working with her long, you know, in various ways. The discussions for the book had started years before, while she kept, deciding and undeciding whether to do it. She was very conflicted about it. And then we had, you know, and even before that, we'd become friends, and I had heard these stories and advised her as she considered whether to write about it. So it wasn't just those couple of years in which we were specifically meeting twice a week for 4 or 5 hours to, you know, go through her entire history. It was years of this, and therefore, to answer your question, I missed her tremendously, which is one of the reasons it's taken so many years after her death to get the book out. I wasn't really able to work on it for a while. I had suffered the loss of my own mother not long before, and she was a wonderful substitute insofar as she was everything you would like in a mother without her being your mother. and so I missed it terribly, and I still do. When you just played that clip of her talking, I felt, oh my God, that was years of my life, and I do miss it terribly. However, when I read the book, I think, okay, I've got her, and now so does anyone else who decides to read the book.
Yeah, she's very alive on the page. About a minute before I have to say goodbye, what do her children think of the book?
Well, you know, the five who survived into adulthood are five really different kinds of people, and I suppose they all have slightly different opinions. They all seem to be positive about it, with their own little criticisms that they're kind enough mostly to keep from me. They've been really supportive, particularly, you know, in the unusual circumstance that her mother put upon them, even in death, that they were not allowed to read the book until it was done.
Fascinating. Well, Jesse Green, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. And he is the chief theater critic for the New York Times. And we've been talking about a book that he collaborated with Mary Rogers on. And it's titled Shy. And it's subtitled The Alarmingly Outspoken Memoirs of Mary Rogers. Go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we want to close things out with the 1959 Broadway cast recording of the song Shy, featuring Carol Burnett from the musical Once Upon a Mattress.
I've always been shy. I confess that I'm shy. Can't you guess that this confident air is a mask that I wear 'cause I'm shy? And you may be sure, way down deep I'm demure, though some people I know might deny it. At bottom I'm quiet and pure. I'm aware that it's wrong to be meek as I am. My chances may pass me by. I pretend to be strong.